Hello nerds and welcome to Into the Wild, your monthly wildlife and conservation podcast where we look at what's going on around the world to do with nature and people. This year we're proudly partnered with the Royal Entomological Society. If you're like Nadia and I and you love insects, then we recommend checking out the RES's new associate membership. For just £15 a year, you can join their thriving global community dedicated and excited by insect science. This membership gives you access to the RES's library services, a digital subscription to Antenna, and discounts on their wide range of events and publications. Follow the link in the write-up of this episode to learn more and join. Are you still in your pajamas, Nadia Sheikh, as we welcome in episode 4?
I am indeed, and it's 4:03 in the afternoon, and I've got no shame about that whatsoever.
Totally forgot what number episode this is of series 2. Is this the 4?
I would like to just give it a random number each time. Welcome to number episode 248.
Of series 17.
Yeah, great.
Long-time listeners, thanks for coming back. New listeners, where have you been?
Wouldn't it be good if we were like the Sugar Babes where...
Yes, absolutely. End of sentence.
Where imagine if there's just like different iterations of the hosts. So
yes.
At one point it wasn't you and somebody else, and now we're like version 8 of Into the Wild.
Version 8.
When you fire me and you get a replacement, just don't talk about it and it'll be like Sugar Babes.
Do you mean like they should be doing for nature presenters on British TV?
Yeah, I... Controversial.
Controversial
No,
statement.
I think it works. I think it works for nature conservation to just have one person for their whole life. That goes for TV and the NGO sector.
Yeah, consistency is key.
I'll just stay here until I die and retire.
Yeah, it's a good book title, that. I'll stay here till I die. Welcome to the show. How
Welcome
are you?
Welcome to Into the Wild. Yeah, brilliant. Swallows have arrived. Ospreys are back on the island.
Jesus, I didn't realise we were starting with a list.
God, I didn't realise you were going to talk about nature on a nature podcast.
I didn't realise there'd be questions. All right, red admirals are in their plenty today.
Lovely.
And so are ashy mining bees.
Ashy mining bees have been like the bee of the week.
They've exploded. Well, I don't know if that's true. I've never counted them before. But there's way more. I'm noticing them more.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, enjoying it.
Isn't that
it?
Lovely when your eye is drawn into something that you...
Mm. And you know
part
what?
Of your landscape.
I really thought, I think before I walked past it, seen them and gone, they're flies. Because they're very dark.
Do you know what? Bees hate that. I've spoken to so many bees and they they are like, if someone
that.
Fucking calls me hoverfly one more fucking time.
I'm not having a go, but we are sexier.
Worth sending it away. Hoverflies are sick of being mistaken
sick
for bees.
Of it. That's why they mimic.
I'm not going to sting you. I'm just going to hover in front of your eyes.
Yeah. Stop running away. I just want to be friends. Well, welcome to another episode, nerds. Lovely to. I hope you're all enjoying spring.
Everybody is. Everyone I talk to is just gushing about
Everyone's
it.
Everyone's going, oh!
They're gushing.
Beautiful, isn't it? I'm in shorts.
They're like, oh, spring. Like
I'm actually wearing
one.
Shorts right now and this beautiful new shirt, which you
also,
see.
Also, a lot of stuff I'm... Yeah, lovely shirt. Nice new shirt. Nadia wears her pyjamas.
I just think, why wouldn't we dress up?
I'm having one of those days where there is a reason that I need to like shower and wash my hair and stuff that's happening tonight.
Mm.
And therefore I'm like, oh, I'll save me shower till in a bit. So there's no point putting day clothes on for...
At 4 o'clock.
Until I've had my shower, basically.
Yeah, otherwise, I think you've already passed the line.
Yeah, the window's gone, hasn't it? Anyway, so that's my kind of day. Well, nice to see you. I'm quite looking forward to this ep.
I know, it could be a bit of a long one, nerds, and a bit of an emotional one, but I'm looking forward to it. Before we get onto the show, though, you know what time it is.
Oh, I know what time it is.
Are you ready? Shall we hear it?
Yeah.
It's time for...
Nature News!
Gets better every time, doesn't it? Gets better every time. Right, do you want to go first or do you want me to go first?
I can go first.
Go on, you go first.
I have some amazing news, everybody.
Oh, share it with the group. Oh, for fuck's sake.
Oh, come on. If I can't plug my own fucking book on my own fucking podcast, why
go
am
on.
I doing it? This is an incredibly outstanding book, basically, that has been launched this week called Wild Service. This is a completely new look at... how we think about the natural world and our relationship with it. I think this book is going to be one of the important books of our time for understanding our place and our relationship with nature. It is called Wild Service, a collection of amazing art authors talking essentially about a philosophy which we did not invent, but we have decided to talk about, because we're not talking about it. So much of our conversations about nature are orientated around science, metrics, measurables, species, numbers. What we're not talking about is our deep relationship that we deserve to have with the natural world. And I'm going to read you a tiny bit of blow about the back. I know I'm not allowed that much time. In May 2022, the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences released a paper that measured 14 European countries on three factors: biodiversity, well-being, and nature connectedness. Britain came last in every single category. The findings are clear. We are suffering and nature is too. Enter Wild Service. Boom. Go buy the book.
Do. Mine arrived today. Very excited.
Cool.
It's nice to be able to hold the book at the same time you are holding the book.
And if you wanted to, if you can't read, which is why you're listening to this podcast, I'm sure, the audiobook is all read by me.
So who doesn't love an audiobook in a Geordie accent?
I started listening to it last night. I'm putting on quite a posh accent for it because I couldn't.
I really hope it is posh and then there's moments where it drops.
That's exactly right.
And I'm sorry, I will apologise. I am not suggesting that you cannot be posh if you're from Newcastle.
I'm suggesting you can't be posh if you're from Newcastle.
Yeah, you can, I can't.
Okay, fine. All right. Okay, that's my news. I have actually got a proper bit of news, but you go next.
Okay, my one. I think I know the face you're going to do when I read this one. So mini rope bridges have been installed in one of England's ancient forests to help hazel dormice travel safely between the treetops. There's the face. I knew the face would happen. Two 20-metre long bridges have been built over a track in the Forest of Dean. The rodents' habitats have become disconnected following the removal of diseased ash trees. Forestry England, which set up the crossing, said that they would enable the dormice to feel safer as they cross from one part of the wood to another. Ecologist Kate Wallen from the organisation explained that dormice do not like to come down to the ground except for hibernation. They feel vulnerable to predators when on the ground. Forestry England says hazel dormice need woodland or hedgerow trees and shrubs to live during the warmer months. So that's just beautiful.
It's just a vision in my head that I needed today.
Well done, Forestry England and the Forest of Dean. I would love to see those in action.
Maybe we can.
Shall we? Should we do a trip?
If anyone from Forestry England is listening and would like us to come down and do a podcast, we would be more than
we'll
happy to come and do that.
We'll give you guys a shout.
Who's going to touch one? That's beautiful.
What's your other bit?
My other little bit of news. It's only a small one, but I don't know. These things leave me split, but they are also glimmers of hope. And this is that in Greece, they are banning bottom trawling fishing around and their MPAs. So the three biggest MPAs are by 2030, bottom trawling is going to be, it's 24, it's another 6 years of bottom trawling. It's not good enough. But by 2026, their biggest MPA, bottom trawling, no more. Let's just hope that that is actually policed. Not policed, but let's hope that that comes into being. Yeah. And through building good relationships with fisheries, local fishing people. Bottom trawling breaks my heart.
I know,
bottom trawling is so destructive.
It's up there with deforestation and all stuff like that, like mass scale.
It's just like clear it out, grubbing out the whole of our... But also we forget that we've done podcasts on it before, we forget that the ecosystem on the ocean floor, on the seabed, is like rich, complex and diverse. Mm. It's not just water with fish in it.
Yes, yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And it's so like... I mean this in a way that's like, it's so undisturbed on that scale. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, we're not talking about things going around and really ripping stuff down, or like you compare it to a forest where like, well, no, trees naturally come down and stuff, but the seafloor is going to be very different to that.
Yeah.
As complex and diverse. So yeah. Okay. Well, that's a good step forward.
It's a good step forward, and pressure
be better,
from anyone
also...
in people that are involved in marine conservation, keep that pressure on so that potentially it happens sooner. But I guess what I'm saying is there are now repeated recognitions that bottom trawling is the fucking shit.
What a way to end nature news. Right, okay, so before we go on to our topic, we just got our other segment, which you ready for the jingle?
Oh.
I want you to review the jingle now after it plays. I want you to tell me how you feel after it. Okay, so nerds, it's time for the
Royal Entomological Segment of the Month.
How do you feel after that? How do you feel about hearing it?
Profoundly engaged more with the world.
We can change it one day. You can record one. I reckon
we
should get you to. Yeah.
You heard me sing at the beginning of the podcast, if Oscar needs that in.
We did. if. So our Royal Entomological Society segment of the month, starting with some publications. There is an online talk on Wednesday, the 9th of May at 4 p.m. on a physiological entomology related session with Nick Teats from the University of Kentucky and Keele University. And there is some new research in the ICAD, which is the Insect Conservation and Diversity, which shows bees need food up to a month earlier than provided by recommended pollinator plants. Next, the ENTO 24, which is the RES's annual meeting dedicated to insect science, will take place from the 10th to the 12th of September in Liverpool. Registration is now live with options for in-person and online and discounts for RES members. And finally, the new RES bug hunting kits with the NHBS are now on sale. These entomological kits are developed by equipment specialists from the NHBS and the RES, which are aimed at enthusiast field entomologists and those in training. The kits are priced competitively with 10% of each purchase donated to the society. And that is the end of the RES segment. And all the links for all the things I've just said are in the write-up of this show.
My God, if you're into bugs, there is so much going on for you.
There is so much in insect science. Seriously, if you're not looking at the RES, I do recommend taking a look. And don't forget, you can become a member for just £15 a year.
And there's so many bugs. No, but it's true, though. Many. If you want to get into something, fuck birds.
Yeah, look under a log. There's way more going on.
You'll be there for 6 hours.
Right, strap yourselves in, nerds. We're going into our main topic. Nadia, are you ready?
I was born ready. This week, month, episode, we are, all of those are true. We are talking about killing for conservation, which I think most of us probably spend time not thinking about.
Yeah, I think so.
You think so? You don't think people do?
I don't think many people think about it.
No, I think maybe we know about it peripherally, but actually, I think if you kind of sat people down and had a conversation, obviously some things get controlled. We have lots of different words for it, right? So we call it control.
Yeah.
We call it management.
We even call it culling.
Culling. Yeah, we have lots of different words. But ultimately, at the end of the day, there is a practice which is very commonplace in our Western conservation, which is we need to decide what lives or dies. And we are the puppet masters of our ecology and our landscapes. That means that through various different means, through various different ideologies and methods and processes and different organizations, individuals and organizations alike, killing happens. Let's have a conversation about it. Why it happens, who's doing it, what are the benefits?
Absolutely. And this is a very emotional and heavy topic to talk about, because I think we try and talk about these things broadly overall, and they're very hard to do because as we learn on this show, you know, sometimes you can go, well, this is obviously the right thing to do. Your gut says that. But actually, when you start to explore what we're doing here and when you start to unpack it, you suddenly become uncomfortable. And I think it's that moment there that we go, well, this is where the question should lie. Mm. You know, should we be continuing if underneath we are uncomfortable with this? So I think this episode's been an interesting week, Nadia, because we've discussed this all week. Every day so far, we've been on Zoom interviewing someone else or discussing this topic. So I've done a lot of reading. Nadia's been doing a lot of reading, and we've been questioning how we feel about this and been talking off record as well. I think me and Nadia talk most days on the phone about the stuff like this. So it's been an interesting journey. Our first chat we're going to bring in is with someone that's been on the podcast before talking about hedgehogs, and this is Hugh Warwick. Now, many of you may know Hugh on social media, a very passionate speaker about what he does, very knowledgeable speaker and a great researcher as well. And he's got a new book that has just come out called Cull of the Wild, which explores this very topic. So Nadia and I wanted to get the opportunity to talk to Hugh about what he has learned on the journey of researching for this book, to hear about some case studies and how he feels about it after a man that has gone out there and read lots of case studies from around the world, what he thinks should be happening. So I'm going to bring in Hugh, and Nadia and I will chat to you afterwards.
Hugh, thanks so much for joining us on this whirlwind of a topic for Into the Wild episode. I read your book, loving your book, and I'm sure we're going to be talking about that as we ask you these questions. But let's just start with an obvious place, because this this topic is quite a different one for you in regards to writing. And I think for me, I was almost, and this, I don't mean this as a negative, but a little bit surprised that someone knowing your work previously, like yourself, was going to talk about this. So I have to ask the obvious place to start. That being the case, what made you want to bring this topic to the world?
Well, this is the topic I've been working on since I started doing fieldwork back in 1986. Way before you were probably born.
The year, that was the year I was born.
Okay, fuck off. But apart from being very old, I was doing my degree at Leicester Polytechnic. I ended up, I think my supervisor was so keen to put as much distance between us as possible that he suggested this idea of heading up to North Ronaldsey, the most northerly of the Orkneys, to look at the impact that imported hedgehogs were having on ground nesting birds. I say this back in 1986. They'd been imported in 1974 by the postman, who had heard on the TV that a really good way of controlling garden pests is hedgehogs. And if you haven't got any hedgehogs where you are, why didn't you get some hedgehogs? Pop them in your garden. And so he went down to Aberdeen, visited an aunt, picked up some hedgehogs, dropped them back on the island. And there was either, it was either a male and a female or a pregnant female. And then they disappeared. And then suddenly they started appearing all over the place, as hedgehogs will do. And their arrival and their expansion coincided with the decrease in breeding success of ground nesting birds, in particular, the Arctic terns. And so the bird observatory was run by the GP because there's only 90 people on the island at that time. And they were just like, well, find somebody, come up here, do some field work. So I went up there to see if the Daily Express was correct in their assessment of the number of hedgehogs on the island. And I just want you, you may gasp at this, but the Daily Express had completely failed in their ability to correctly present scientific evidence.
And
I think they'd written something about there being 10,000 hedgehogs on the island. It was about 500. Anyway, it was an interesting project, and it was the beginning of my independent field work. I went back up there in 1991 to see what happened, because they'd airlifted a bunch of hedgehogs off after I'd left.
Airlifted?
Yeah, well, it's a long way by boat for the poor things.
I know, but you said it and I pictured it happening individually, one at a time.
Well, no. They boxed them up. That'd be silly. I mean, obviously.
I know, but that's how my brain works.
So but then you see what cute.
But you see, what was funny about that is that then, so I've got friends at Nottingham Trent University doing some work back on North Ronaldsey. And they say, well, what happened to the hedgehogs? There's no written evidence. I say, well, it was in the press. They arrived on mainland Scotland, were popped on the train, and then distributed all over the country because people had adopted them. I think some ended up in the Isle of Wight.
World War II orphans.
Oh, God, that's so just British. That's so British. Adopt a hedgehog.
1945, was this?
So I'm not that old. So I went back in 1991 to repeat the same sort of work, looking at the impact on ground nesting birds, and found I spent a lot more time studying the bird life then, in particular looking at the other impacts that the Arctic terns were facing. And counting and measuring sand eels they were bringing in their beaks. And have either of you ever sat in an Arctic tern colony?
No.
Actually, not in breeding season.
Okay.
In the safe season.
Yeah, in the safe season. Because they're known on Orkney as Pecky Terno. And they're pecky little bastards. And they will hover above your head. And then they will dive down and attempt to impale their beak into your skull. And it is absolutely terrifying. Going out with the bird people to ring chicks on nests, I made a policy of always walking next to somebody much taller than me. And one of the other people there, he had his woolly hat, and he had a tobacco tin underneath it. And you could hear tink, tink as the beaks. Anyway, it's scary. But they were having far less food being brought to them than previous projects had shown. Hedgehogs were having an impact. But what it showed was that it was a multi-layered problem. Farming practices were changing. There was less food for the birds. Which was possible even then, back in 1991, to do with possible warming in the oceans, because it meant that the plankton on which the sand eels fed was moving further away and out into deeper water, which meant that the sand eels were going further away, which meant that these Arctic terns had to travel further, which meant that the nests were emptier for longer, which meant that when they turned back up, the Arctic skuas, the kleptoparasites galore, would be hovering around there waiting to nobble them. It was complicated. But so when you say this isn't the sort of subject which I'd be interested in, that then led me to become involved with the Uist hedgehog story. So back in 2003, the RSPB and Nature Scotland, as it is now, started killing hedgehogs in the Outer Hebridean Islands of the Uists for exactly the same set of problems, which began in the same year. I think it was the same news story stimulated the same problem. And I went up there to cover that story for Radio 4 and got there and found that they were using some of my research to justify killing the hedgehogs as opposed to translocating them. I actually went up there assuming that they were killing the hedgehogs because something new had been discovered, which meant that they couldn't be translocated. When I found they were using my research inappropriately, I got grumpy, joined the campaign, and 3 years later did the research which ended up stopping the cull of hedgehogs in the Outer Hebrides. So no, I've been involved with this stuff. That was quite a long answer, sorry. I've been involved with this sort of stuff right since the beginning.
Yeah,
but that's it. That's the main. But you haven't written about it, as in this kind of format before, have you?
In A Prickly Affair, my first book, I did write quite a bit about the conflict up on in Uist and in Orkney. But this is the first time I've sort of gone. You see, but what's interesting, that Prickly Affair, all of that was about stuff I knew because I did it.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
What's been an interesting exercise for me in this is a whole bunch of stuff that I didn't know, which I didn't do. And therefore, the exploration of meeting people who are experts in their own field and getting them to talk to me has been absolutely fascinating.
Yeah, that's a really great start. I guess what I'm hearing and what I'm quite often interested in as a conservationist and an ornithologist, which you said that you don't like.
I didn't say I don't like ornithologists.
And also, I also mock. That's fair.
Well, I mean, basically, how can you not?
I know. We open the door all the time. I actually just, anyway, I'm not going to go into that. I guess I'm really interested in, because obviously conservation at the moment and how we preserve habitats, everything is so like science focused, or supposedly it's science focused. But obviously you were just telling us about your first experience has really tied you throughout your career. So I guess from like a feeling space, how has it felt for you as a conservationist researching this book when there are all these sticky topics of killing for conservation? I'm interested in that journey for you personally.
Well, I mean, I begin the book, actually the first draft of the book began with the word prejudice. I was going to begin it like that. I'm going to come straight out the gate with, here are my prejudices. Mm-hmm. I have not eaten meat for nearly 40 years. I was 10 years a strict vegan. I was quite good at being a strict vegan, but then I started doing lots of talks for the Women's Institute and I discovered that my willpower was not as strong as their cakes were good.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
So I am now what I declare as a vegan. I'm sort of vaguely vegan. Yeah, oat milk on my muesli, soy milk in my tea, but WI cakes fit a different category. So that's a vaguely vegan lifestyle. I abhor killing for pleasure. I find it, it makes me physically sick. I really do have a complete physiological reaction to the sight, to the experiences of people who get pleasure from killing animals. It's something which I really, really struggle with. So feelings, they're quite big in this whole thing. And I needed to meet people who are killing an awful lot. Mm-hmm. Some people were killing very much for pleasure. Some people were killing to enable them to kill for pleasure. And some people were killing animals entirely not enjoying it in the slightest, but only because they knew that there was a goal which they could achieve only by killing. And I found that my feelings were challenged a great deal. I had to work very hard at meeting people at a level where there was connection. And this is something which I found really important, and it's changed a bit about how I see people. It says that when I'm meeting people who we may have very different perspectives on certain things, you find the common ground first. If you begin with the common ground and you find how much you both love nature and you both love Sibelius. Oh, there's one guy from the Game of Wild, who was at the Game of Wildlife Conservation Trust, and our biggest conflict turned out to be over who had recorded the best version of Sibelius's Fifth Symphony. Despite the fact that we actually had this sort of fundamental difference of opinion about enjoying killing things, that was where we actually had the deepest discussion, because actually there's really very little point challenging that bit because we have exactly opposite opinions. If we can find all the common ground that we share, maybe then that can open the door to progress. What is the point of argument? It was Joseph Joubert, I think it is, who's the point of argument is not to win, but to make progress. So this was about trying to find, for both of us, learning opportunities about how things could be in each of these potential situations. However, there were situations where I never made it. I never made it into hang out with some of the harder edged gamekeepers, the ones who work for the industrial production of pheasants and the like. And every time I got closer, I found myself realizing that I was either going to burst into tears or start shouting, and neither of which were going to be constructive. So
did you have any small conversations? What was the extent of getting in?
Well, I did in the end. I spent a day with a lovely gamekeeper called Mike Swan, and his absolute passion, the reason he works so hard as he does, is he likes nothing better than an armed nature ramble. That's what he likes to do. And the only way he can have his armed nature ramble is to keep a control on certain species which are on the land he manages, i.e. kill them. And you know what? Mike's absolutely great. Really, really like him. We agree on so much. It's just that armed nature ramble bit where we disagree.
I find that so fascinating because I don't know. I think I'm resonating with a lot of what you're saying. It's whole part of just seeing people as humans as well, isn't it? It's just going like, we're not that different. We're here for very similar reasons, unless, like you said, the very surface level can be different. But you dig deeper and you start talking to people and you can have a very decent chat and actually start, like you say, start opening doors that maybe you thought you weren't ever going to open together, like whether it's finding the same music you like or just going, I like to go down this route on this walk as well, if it's in your local area. I find that kind of human behaviour of conversation fascinating with stuff like
that. Well, so there's something else. I had to read an awful lot of stuff about philosophy because, you know, this stuff has been talked about for generations. Mm-hmm. And there was a thing Bertrand Russell wrote, and it was a moment of going, you know what?
Oh, Bertie.
This is it. This is the actual thing. He managed to explain it so absolutely perfectly that I actually record, here we go. It's a 1934 essay. And he said, perhaps instead of teaching manners, parents should teach the statistical probability that the person you are speaking to is just as good as you are. It is difficult to believe this. Very few of us do, in our instincts, believe it. One's own ego seems so incomparably more sensitive, more perceptive, wiser, and more profound than other people's. Yet there must be very few of whom this is true, and it is not likely that oneself is one of those few. There is nothing like viewing oneself statistically as a means both to good manners and to good morals. Mm. And I just thought, that's it. That is this. When I was young, I knew I was right. It was very straightforward. This whole getting older thing is really, really bloody difficult because, oh gosh, possibly, maybe I'm not.
Mm. Yeah.
I am, obviously, but yeah.
Oh, of course, yeah. No, let's not step away from that.
I guess the world that we live in now, we can quite easily remove ourselves from being around people who we don't agree with more often than not, really, which is, I think we found ourselves in this predicament now where we can all just exist separately.
Well, actually, the whole chunk of the book is about that. Right at the beginning, you know, I talk about my bubble. And my bubble convinces me on a daily basis that I'm right. Of course it does. And in fact, it convinces me that my perceptions of most issues are fairly half-hearted. Because, you know, there I am thinking that, you know, moderate views and things might be good. But no, it's a really, really challenging thing to go, actually, maybe we need to look outside our own little bubbles. And in fact, in the end, I ended up, the last words of the book are fine wine, which I think is a good way of doing these things. There's some wonderful work done by Rory Stewart on a Radio 4 series about argument and debate. And in the end, he argued that political discourse used to be very much in the shape of a bell curve, a normal distribution curve, that most people's views tended towards sort of the middle-ish, and you had small numbers of extremists, extreme views on either side. Or it'd be three-dimensional, four-dimensional, how many. But now what's happened with the rise of social media, we have been encouraged, because outrage is the way we get attention and attention is currency, we have now created a wine glass, an empty wine glass. And that middle is totally up. So basically what I'm arguing is we just need some, I'd suggest claret, really nice claret. Fill that wine glass and then share it and make sure it keeps full so that we don't end up creating that massively polarized way of arguing.
Beautiful.
Well, how do the British public tend to respond to methods such as lethal control with wildlife? And do you think they change at all when they learn more about the reasons why or anything?
So what I find is that you've got a number of different sorts of schools of thought on these things. You'll have people who are absolutely determinedly, deontological is the technical term I come up with. They have a view, it's either right or it's wrong. And it's simple as that. And there's no shifting. And then there's what I realize I have developed is a sort of utilitarian way of thinking where you end up with sort of weight checks and balances, your spreadsheet, as it were. And so in terms of the reactions so far have all been extremely positive. I'm waiting for the pushback. There will be. Mm. But the book is written in such a way as I am. I wrote an opinion piece for The New Scientist, which should be coming out in the week or so's time. And in that, they were saying, well, you know, give us more of the fight. You know, people shouting at each other. I say, well, actually, the book is more me shouting at myself. It's more the internal struggle. Because I've got plenty of that going on in my own head. And anybody who reads the book, I mean, I did a lecture, I do lectures at Brooks University, and somebody posted a picture of the book cover from the Bloomsbury website and saying what a fantastic thing this was. Somebody started shouting on Twitter, and somebody else started shouting on Twitter about, oh, you're killing animals, yada, 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 yada. And I said, well, I think you probably ought to wait until you've read it before you draw an opinion. Oh, you're just saying that because you had, and he was just shout, 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 shout. And then about a day later, the same person came back on Twitter and just said, well, I've just looked at your social media feed. You probably are not saying that, are you? And I'll read it.
Nice.
I think anybody reading it would be hard pushed to take to an extreme of view, but it'd be very easy not to read it and form a very strong opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. The two aren't mutually exclusive because I think reading it, you can tell the research that's gone into it. I think you balance it very well, actually, on this topic. You do go into, I can see that argument you're having with yourself, actually, when you've said that now knowing the chapters I've read, I can go, actually, I can see you having that. It's very fascinating that you put it like that, because you kind of, you're almost debating, you're saying the science side, and then you're talking your emotional side of it, and then almost getting a bit confused in the chapter with yourself, going, wait a minute, I've just learned something and I'm not happy about it.
No, and that's exactly it. I mean, yeah. And it is, you know, that really is at the heart of it. I mean, I've, you know, a number of times it's been, I remember ages ago, I was, I'd been doing field work. A badger had eaten a hedgehog on, right, and I was thinking, well, it seemed like it was a minor occurrence. The evidence I'd read elsewhere, it was a minor impact on hedgehogs. And, then I met a bloke who'd been doing his PhD on, the asymmetric intraguild predatory relationship between hedgehogs and badgers. And presented a very clear case, which showed that actually badgers do have a conservation level impact on hedgehogs. So therefore, because that is the way science is, you go, okay, I have to change my mind. Mm-hmm. Because actually, I could carry on saying, oh, no, they don't have an impact. But the evidence is now clearly here showing that they do. Mm. And that's, you know, that has been the sort of path of the book.
Mm.
Yeah, that's really interesting. There's so much I want to ask you about this, but then, you know, for the purposes of keeping the conversation on track, I won't. But I actually think it is one of those really beautiful feelings, actually, when you let go and accept a new perspective to come in, that tension in your body to let go and go, okay, I am changed and that's okay. Yeah. And it's safe to do that. Even when you're just arguing with one person and you're like, okay, yeah. Go, okay, I see your point of view. And then,
okay, but Nadia, so I kind of pull you up on that, just because actually it's not, there's not necessarily a good feeling, because sometimes you're doing that and you're losing your allies. You're losing your friends, in a sense, because the people who you had agreed with were your bubble. Yeah. And suddenly you've seen inside, and you don't necessarily know people there. It becomes a much more, it can become quite a lonely space.
I think so. But also, if a friendship is going to fail on the back of having your opinion changed, it's not a strong friendship, unless that engagement or that relationship you've got with someone is purely work-based and that destroys potential future working relationships. Again, it's their problem, which is one of the battles we've got. You know, I left largely the conservation sector because the problems within it that I feel like weren't being addressed, and I couldn't do it within the sector. And I feel like I've lost a part of me and a part of the people who helped make me, because I wanted to ask challenging questions and they weren't ready to answer those challenging questions. And actually, it's just, I think it's a shift, you know, where I'm at. But this is not my therapy session, Hugh. And that's why on this podcast, Ryan and I really do try and look at the UK conservation model and the work that we do, but in the context globally, we want to understand global systems, global humanity in all its cultures and shapes and sizes in order to understand what's going on, why we think the way that we do. And so I guess, given that, like in our Western society, so there's been recently a study done in 2022 that measured all European countries for biodiversity, nature connectedness, and something else. And the UK came last, I can't remember the last one. The UK came last in all categories. So we do have a deep disconnect from nature. Do you think that that plays into the uneasiness about wildlife being killed here in the UK, whereas maybe actually people feel less uneasy about it kind of in other countries or looking at other countries?
I think that's quite an enormous misrepresentation of probably the majority of the world. Certainly talking to a wonderful academic, I say her name correctly, Prerna Singh Bindra, who's currently in Cambridge, and she was talking about the situation in India. There's absolutely no killing for conservation in India. The idea of it is just like, why would you do that? It's ridiculous. Why would you do that? She was saying we have maybe 500 people killed by elephants a year, but you don't kill elephants for there may be some revenge. She's not naive, but there is you don't kill for conservation. I gave a lecture in the Natural History Museum in Oxford, and I was having dinner, and two people on the table, they were both from Southeast Asia, and both of them, both women, and they're both very gently spoken, but you could see they had a complete lack of any understanding about why people would kill for conservation. Mm. And so I think that there is a really, we have got a very specific utilitarian mind view about these things. So we want to try and find a way through these things, try and overcome, try and win the battle with nature. And there are very different perspectives out there. Mm. So I would say actually the majority of people I've had connection with about this topic, it's more been, that's a sort of a subject we don't really like to talk about too much, but... And it's this is a conversation which has a lot of people with a butt face. It begins and then they go, but. And then it becomes a moment of going, we understand, but we just don't like talking about it.
I guess you're right. I guess the question was around like the UK population's kind of distaste when they hear about killing for conservation. And is that just because we're disconnected from nature? But maybe fundamentally there is just like it's feeling weird because... It is weird.
There's distaste because it's shit.
Yeah.
I mean, and the reason we're doing it is because our ancestors have been fucking stupid. Mm-hmm. We've done things. Sorry, is this a swearing podcast or not? Sorry. But we have done, we humans have done really stupid things. We have taken animals to places and plants, though I didn't touch on plants because that's way too much. We've taken things to places and they've caused chaos. We've mismanaged the countryside so that it's utterly bankrupt and degraded, so that it's disordered and we have things going wrong. We've done all of this stuff. And so we should have utter, complete distaste because we shouldn't have to do it. We shouldn't be living in a situation where we have so much mess to take. My problem is, what do we do about it? Mm-hmm. And I'm getting gesticulatory disease. Do we do like a toddler and go, we'll let nature take its course? And it's like, no, all we're doing is dumping the responsibility for tidying up the mess that we, our ancestors, have made on the shoulders of our already very, very heavily burdened nature.
But I guess there is one thing following from Nadia's question, because this is something, when we say humans have done this, humans haven't. A very specific region of humans have done this. There's it's our ancestors did it. There's the ancestors of indigenous Namibians didn't spread wildlife around the world. It was
I know, but you can't romanticize indigenous peoples because you've got wherever.
No, I'm not romanticizing. I'm saying when we say humans did this, it wasn't for me. That's not entirely accurate. We my ancestors did it. But when, from Nadia's question of going, do you think like the British public are more uneasy about killing? Because there are cultures out there that are fine with removing wildlife from, the ecosystem, whether it's for use or whether it's for control or just removing an animal that's in there. They are fine with that. I think it's interesting. Do you think a Western society struggles with that more than an indigenous community somewhere else? I think that's an interesting...
Okay, I mean, I would say that in the Americas, where hunting is quite such a, certainly North America and the United States of America, hunting is such a massive thing. Killing killing full stop is a much easier thing to do. Mm. You look at New Zealand, what you've got there is an absolutely amazing push to create the enemy.
Oh, they're all and the doing enemy, it.
Yeah, and but it's being done. It's being done in schools. It's like, come on, see how many you can kill today.
Possum killing day.
And it's becoming. And I spoke to this really fascinating academic called Wayne Linklater. He was from New Zealand. Wayne Linklater, and he's now in he's in Sacramento. And he was just saying, you know, the thing is, it is the biggest diversionary tactic. Mm. So New Zealand's operating as predator free by 2050 plan, trying to eradicate five different predators in particular by then. And it is a complete distraction from the complete disaster that has been industrial agriculture, extractive industries, which have taken place since humanity arrived there, but more effectively since European society arrived there. And that we are deeply seduced by Lord of the Rings, and that New Zealand isn't just like that, really. And the reason why these invasive non-native species, as they are known, have gained such a foothold there is because we have gifted them the niche.
I mean, I've just written a chapter in a book that's come out all about this kind of stuff. But I think it's a really good point that you make, is this kind of like urgency to just kill the fuckers. And actually it's the same ideology and urgency and fix it solution focused thinking that has caused the problems in the first place.
But the short termism of it is fascinating. It's like, well,
it's just like kill them.
Get him.
Guy called Mark Beckoff, who sort of founded the whole compassionate conservation movement, the point he makes is that people are looking at these problems in the time frame of completing their PhD or a grant application, rather than the fact that in about 500 years' time, ecosystem services will be returned to wherever they were. Wayne Linklater was saying, the rats which New Zealand are trying to eradicate now, give it a few hundred years and a return to a more sort of undegraded environment, those rats are going to be New Zealand rats, and there will be people campaigning to protect them. Things will change over time. Mm. What we need to be looking at is his argument, Wayne's argument, is this, what is it we're fighting for? What is the species really, this totem that we need to, that the hill we're going to die on is the species, or is it a functioning ecosystem? And for me, this was some of the stuff is towards the end of the book when I was going, oh my God, this is just, I can't cope. Because yes, I treasure the idea of species. I really relish that idea of the biodiversity which comes of it. But he's saying, no, this is such a narrow view of these things.
Oh, but Hugh, have you seen a kiwi?
Bird, not fruit.
Yeah. How am I going to see a kiwi?
I just think they're really cute. I know, I get what you're saying, but you know, like a mortal.
I love the way Hugh said all that, and your counterpoint was kiwi.
Yeah, I mean, and if you wanted to win it, go with echidna. That's better.
An echidna. I'd love to see an echidna. I know, but like we like these exotic species that have enchanted us at some point in our formative years, where you learn about it and you're like, you know, that is also what it is.
That's why people like cows in farms, even though the fact they're killing the planet. It's a large
people,
part of bullshit
I think,
in all these
children,
things.
I think there is an upper age limit, I think, in it 7 years old to be that fascinated by a cow. Oh, dear.
But people get excited by pandas. They're just an evolutionary dead end, you know. It's just it's just leave
kill
it be. Well, just you don't need to be quite so active about it, Ryan. You do realize I'm recording this, so I'm going to be taking segments out of this and using them out of context.
Yeah. It's just going to be a 5-minute voice.
Okay, Ryan,
kill him.
They're gone.
So the purpose of the book is to try and give some degree of sort of subtlety to what can be quite a vigorous area of contention. But also, I mean, there is humour to be had in there because of the ridiculousness of it. And you can look at this and be very po-faced and be terribly, terribly sort of austere about it. But actually, as I say, and I'm going to say, we, humanity, in all its forms, have done stupid things. I actually argue in the book that Homo sapiens is the most unlikely and inappropriate Linnaean binomial. And that actually I worked it out. We should be known as Homo otisor, which is man the killer.
Very
I know. Yeah, sorry. Sorry, I've brought it down again, haven't I? Sorry.
That's the end of our... We'll see you.
Lovely. Remember to follow us on social media.
Ryan, ask a good last question.
Yeah. So
last question is, now you've done a lot of this research and you've spoken to the people you have and you've kind of looked at different case studies and you've searched for the nuance, And I don't expect a binary answer here, but or have you sat in that pool and kind of decided where you sit on this kind of topic?
Okay, so it has to be done case by case. To take a very prescriptive view and just say everything is going to be like this is just a nonsense. What's been interesting is that throughout the course of doing this, the RSPB has got four tenets that they will do before they'll kill anything. The RSPB has been brilliant at being honest about the fact that they'd kill some animals to protect other animals. And they used to keep it very hidden, but then the gamekeepers shout at the RSPB, say, nah, 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 and it becomes horrible again. Then Tony Martin, amazing guy who's basically removed all the mink from East Anglia. Pretty much done it.
Wow.
And he's doing it. And he now reckons...
One guy?
But he got a team.
Well, he's been on the phone.
Okay.
To people. But yeah, he's done it. Yes. And with a team of people now doing it using remote control traps, which catch animals, send a ping back. And it's a potentially doable thing. But he wrote a paper and he had six points, was it? Which is basically, whether it's doable, whether it can... All of the sort of things you've got to tick before you can kill anything. And then an amazing woman called Sarah Dubois, who's in British Columbia now, she did a paper which looked at key pulling together. I think it's eight key points. And it's saying you can't go killing unless, one, is it really a problem? Two, can you stop the problem by stopping doing something else? Mm-hmm. Yeah, New Zealand, for example, maybe reining back in extractivist industries. Is it possible to do it so that you'll actually succeed? Because there's no point. The example I'll give you is grey squirrels, okay? There's a bunch of people, kill them, kill them, kill them. That's the headline in a Guardian article, actually. Just killing grey squirrels year after year after year is all you're doing is harvesting grey squirrels. You're taking a crop each year. You're not solving the problem. However, Craig Shuttleworth, amazing, this was pretty much one individual, has killed 7,000 grey squirrels by hand on Anglesey. And now, thanks to him, there are red squirrels back on Anglesey. So he has had two grey squirrels back in the last week or so. They're probably jumping in on vehicles moving across, or sometimes you'll get some absolute arse who decides it's funny to release them back over there. And yeah, there's the risk of squirrel pox, obviously, getting to the island. So can it actually be done? There's no point doing it and doing it forever. That's just ridiculous. Do it and do it as quickly as you can, as brutally as you can, maybe as you can, if necessary, to do it as quickly as possible. And then what Sarah Dubois brings into the equation, which none of the others had, is cruelty. Because one of the things which is, if you're looking at this as a sort of a utilitarian spreadsheet for these things, you can look at all these things. You can look at the money, you can look at the time, you can look at the efficacy of these things. But can you, as the person who's doing it, deciding to do it and actually actively doing it, can you take ownership for the cruelty you are handing out to a whole bunch of individuals? Alex Simmons wrote an amazing book called Treated Like Animals. Really, really recommend that book. And in that, he makes that point. It's like, these animals have the capacity to suffer joy and happiness and fear and pain. And we are going to inflict on those animals, using rodenticides, a fucking hideous death.
Mm.
Can we put that honestly in the spreadsheet and accept it? Mm-hmm. And so all of these things need to be ticked. So it's not a case of saying yes or no. It's a case of going, okay, in this instance, can we do it? Can we not have to do it because we stop being stupid? And can we minimize cruelty? So I think that's the sort of, for me, the take home of these things mm-hmm. is it needs an awful lot more very careful research, very careful learning and appreciation of all aspects of the ecosystem and also the society's willingness to take it on as well. Because this is actually a human problem as well. Yeah, in terms of there's no point doing it if you have a society who's going to say no.
Amazing. It's a really beautiful point to land on, because that feeling, which I always talk about, the feeling space, having grace and empathy and being in that space of how much can we do this to ourselves as a species to ignore the pain and suffering of other things. You cannot extract that from the work that we do and expect the work to be a success. So a really nice point to close on.
Thank you so much for coming on the show, Hugh, and giving.
I feel
your
we should end with a joke, though. Sorry, it's gone really serious.
God. No,
don't
go on.
No, I got that.
Look it up.
I'm also just interested in the mink that are killed. Do they get made into coats?
So I asked Tony about this, and he kept the first 100. Because he thought maybe if the project doesn't work, he could do something with them. But actually, thousands have been killed. It, bizarrely, it's gone now. But the process of writing the book, I had a mink coat hanging beside me. When my mother died and we're clearing out the house, I had absolutely no idea she'd kept her mink coat from the 1960s or 1970s. And it was at the back of the wardrobe. And when as soon as I touched it, I was transported back to this time when she would come and kiss me goodnight. And she was going up downstairs, the smell of her perfume and the feel of that coat. And so this mink coat was, for the purpose of writing this book, it was sitting beside me, hanging here. And it was a really interesting sort of process to have that in mind. You know, we've done this and I really love fur, but I just really prefer fur on living animals.
Yeah.
Really prefer fur on living
but
animals.
I will remind you, Hugh, I am recording this, so I will take that.
Oh, take that bit totally out of context.
It's a game that we play.
Yeah, there you go. We finished on a laugh. There we go.
Good. And I'll tell you what, if anybody firebombs my house, I'm sending a bill to you.
Yeah, we'll just pay it out our budget.
Sorry, Oscar, you don't get paid for that one. Right, thank you so much for coming on the show, Hugh. Really appreciate it.
That's grand. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Hugh.
Huge thanks, mate.
Yeah. I hope you enjoyed that conversation that we had, and maybe you'll think about buying Hugh's book. But yeah, it's left me feeling there's something in there that I feel like is a really important thread or a really important nuanced point that I think needs to be given a little bit of weight. And that is just this, you know, I said at the top of this item around we have so many different names for killing and culling. And I think that's because as a culture within Western conservation and more broadly anyway, there is such a sense of urgency to put things right. Our need to do conservation quickly and urgently so that we can get the thing back to the thing in the way it was within our lifetime. Like, we want to see ecosystem repair in our lifetime. We want to see all of the nice animals and wildlife in our lifetime. Our ability to have long-term thinking and big systemic changes fundamentally in how we repair our ecosystems kind of brushed aside for the, like, look, if we can just kill all of these things now, in 5 years' time, we could have, like, everything back to the way it should be, whatever it should be is. So whilst I acknowledge that this country has, like, jumbled up its ecosystem so much that there are cases, I think, you know, Hugh was right, case-by-case basis, there are cases like deer where actually there are no predators left, so we are the predator and we can eat it and there is, you know, a source there. What is missing from that, I think, is that when it comes to choosing to take a life, an important part of what it is to be human, which I think we've lost from our culture, is to have respect, ritual, and grace for taking that life. And we replace that with our grief at loss of the thing that's missing. And the thing that we kill is a proxy for that grief.
Yeah, yeah.
So you don't have to lament the loss of the thing that you're killing, because you're like, it's okay, I'm doing good, because it's so other things can live. You know, we can still respect and have due consideration for the lives that have been taken and have ways and systems around that. I think for me, conservation is always scientific and it is always driven, or it seems to be for me quite often, it is scientific, it's metric based, it's measurable stuff, numbers on paper, for a nostalgia or that like need to get things right. So it's complicated. I still think that we probably had some more nuance to dig into that conversation around the kind of the Western squeamishness around death.
Well, that's the big thing. I think I really want to revisit on that, if you don't mind me cutting in there, because I think it was a point that we almost discussed, and it kind of we went off of it as well, because we do have that squeamishness in this, especially in the UK, over death and loss and stuff. And I think whilst we can have, you know, many of us be very upset at the thought of like maybe deer being culled or being shot or quote unquote controlled population wise, you know, we'll have a large population going, that's horrible, I don't want to think about that, whilst at the same time eating chicken from a farm that cannot be traced back to where they got it from. I think there's a level of kind of, that's where it shows the disconnect, you know, or just not even be fussed or aware that sewage is being poured in our rivers, you know, it's that kind of disconnect,
dissonance,
you know, dissonance. So I think that's kind of where I have seen, and I understand that other cultures exist that understand and respect the loss and grief of wildlife all the time, because they give back as well as take.
Nice. Suffering is part of life.
Mm-hmm. Unfortunately. So absolutely. Oh my god, can you hear that chirping noise?
Can you hear that?
What?
Yeah, no. You know what that means.
Whoa.
We've just stumbled across insects. So subtle. It's time to bring in a voice that's going to talk to us about this topic, Nadia, about killing or controlling or kind of doing some intervening with non-native insects. In the same way we've just spoken a lot about mammals and that kind of group with Hugh, we're now going to look at insects, specifically wasps. And we are going to talk to Serian Sumner from UCL, who works a lot with the Royal Entomology Society. She's going to come in and talk to us about wasps and the control. So here is Serian. Serian, it's lovely to have you back on Into the Wild. For people that have not listened for a while or at all previously, you have been on the show before, but do you want to just quickly introduce yourself and tell us who you are and what you do?
Yes, thanks for having me back. I am Serian Sumner. I am a professor of behavioural ecology at University College London, and I have a particular fondness of wasps.
And that is a beautiful picture of a wasp behind you, I have to say. That is beautiful. Is that a print?
It is a very large print, yes. It's an Ammophila, it's a digger wasp. And it's not a social wasp, it's a solitary wasp, but it's rather beautiful, yeah.
It is absolutely stunning. Yeah. I love it. I want to get more art like that in my house. Where did you get it?
I think it was just a print I found online. And then my daughter ended up printing it. So this is enormous A3 poster.
The Sumner family comes together for wasp art.
I think to be fair, she was printing a load of stuff for her own bedroom, which was not wasp related. And then I think she thought that if she put a wasp in it, I would end up paying for it and therefore not notice that I'd also bought her a load of prints as well.
God, she's a genius. Yeah, she's going to go far in life, that one. Well, it's lovely to have you back. For listeners that have not heard of Serian before, we did a wonderful episode on wasps. And it's an episode that's always stayed with me because it was so funny, so interesting, and a lovely chat. So if you haven't listened to that episode, do go back. But today, we can talk about wasps again, but from a very specific angle, because of the topic of this episode, we're talking about kind of the control, the lethal control potentially sometimes of non-native species, maybe species that we have brought in ourselves to other countries throughout whatever historical reason. So Serian, my first question to you is, in the wasp world, is there cases where lethal control is used because they're non-native where they are, and why are they there?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, I think wasps are some of the most successful invasive species in the world, along with other social insects, actually. So ants are also very successful. Mm-hmm. So there's lots of invasive ants that we could talk about. But coming back to wasps, which is my beloved topic. Us Brits, kindly introduced the common yellow jacket wasp to New Zealand about 40 odd years ago. And that's not been good for New Zealand. And these wasps have become established there and they form enormous colonies, probably because they have no natural predators there. And they are incredibly damaging to the ecosystems. And so it's kind of weird because I know some of the wasp researchers in New Zealand and here in the UK, I'm going, hey guys, love the wasps because they're really important and really, really good and valuable members of the ecosystem because they're nature's pest controllers and pollinators. And then on the other side of the world in New Zealand, they're going, kill the wasp, we must kill the wasp.
Total switch.
Yeah, and I have to say that actually they have a point because there are, I don't know if you know about these, the beech woodlands that they have, these beech forests that they have in New Zealand. Yeah. I've never been to New Zealand. I have been to some.
Absolutely jaw-droppingly beautiful.
But have you been at the time when the wasps are active?
I don't recall. It was just some time ago. It was about 15 years ago. So I don't remember that.
I think there will certainly have been wasps 15 years ago, but you maybe went at the wrong time of year or the right time of year, depending on
what you're... I was there in winter, actually.
There we go. Yeah. So at wasping season, you know, in the height of summer, the wasps are there in such high numbers that they basically just exclude so many other parts of the ecosystem. So they will exclude other insect predators. They also feed off the sugary honeydew that these aphids produce, which feed off the trees, and the honeydew would normally be dropping to the ground, and it fosters an entirely unique ecosystem of fungi and bacteria in the forest floor, which is really important for the maintenance of that rich ecosystem. So by the wasps taking away this incredibly nutritious source, they're altering not just the other predators that might come along and eat the aphids or farm the honeydew from the aphids. It's also altering the kind of the soil
and
the
whole
ecosystem is being affected. So this is a case where it is not good to love wasps.
Yeah.
And I think,
disclaimer, love them, but not there.
And there is an enormous amount of effort going into the control of wasps in New Zealand. Mm. And in fact, there's a good friend of mine, Bob Brown, is a scientist in New Zealand who comes here, who works on the biocontrol of wasps. And he comes to the UK every year in September time to dig up our wasp colonies in order to find beetles and parasitoid wasps and the hoverfly larvae that live inside the wasp nests and eat the larvae of the wasps. And then he takes those back to New Zealand as potential biocontrol agents. And he's just got permission now, I think, to release some of those into the wild to see if they're, into the wild. Did you see what I did
Very
there?
Good. You noticed before I did, actually, which says a lot about me as a host of the show.
Into the wild. To see if they're going to somehow help control or at least, dampen down those wasp populations, because it's not clear. We don't actually know in the UK how much these parasites of the wasp nests are helping keep populations in check, but the fact that they are native predators of these wasp nests must mean that they are having an impact. And so New Zealand doesn't have anything that's predating on these wasps, so they need to sort of introduce things that might be of help. So that's really, really interesting and really fun.
Were the wasps, I'm assuming, because this seems to be the case when we're looking at species like this, were they introduced to New Zealand as a pest control?
Oh, no, it was totally accidental. I mean, the great thing...
Oh, really? Complete accident?
Yeah.
Whose fault was that?
Well, I mean, I know. Cargo, basically.
Imagine if it was one guy.
I know.
Sorry.
It's only a few introductions. I think they have done the genetics to work out how many introductions. I can't remember off the top of my head how many it is, but it's a small number of mated queens. Because all you need is a...
Yes,
because Hymenoptera store all the sperm that they need to lay all their eggs in a little sac in their abdomen called the spermatheca. And in the case of social wasps, like the yellow jacket wasp, they mate with multiple males. And so they're actually even just one queen arriving in New Zealand would have this genetic diversity in its brood because it's mated with multiple males. That then doesn't mean it goes through this classic sort of genetic bottleneck when you only have a few founders.
Oh, shit, a break. That's not good news.
Well, that's partly why
social... Well, it is for the wasp.
Yeah, I mean, that's partly why social insects are such successful invaders of different regions, because they are often... Firstly, they store sperm, so you only need a female. You don't need a male and a female. And secondly, they are often multiple males. So they have that genetic diversity.
So they go down that bottleneck. Like you said, this is interesting then, because when we're looking at the biocontrol, is there not a risk there that introducing more predatory species could lead us further down a tunnel that we don't want to be? I mean, are there other ways of controlling this? Or is this a test here to go, let's see if this can be controlled and worked, and if not, we'll try something else?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think New Zealand has possibly the strictest biocontrol rules in the entire world. Mm. And I know the work that they've been doing before releasing these potential biocontrol agents is very, very rigorous, and they've tested it in all different ways. But you're right. I mean, I think they did an introduction of a biocontrol agent in Northern Europe and Scandinavia recently, and they realised that actually it looked like it was safe, except there was a bacteria or a virus inside the biocontrol agent. You couldn't possibly have preempted that. So though, I think we are playing with fire a little bit when we use these biocontrol agents to control. But they're doing lots of other stuff in New Zealand. And in fact, I think This is publicly available information on the internet, but you might possibly want to check it before you actually put this out.
Always good when we have a scientist on the show saying that.
I know that scientists in New Zealand have been given a very large amount of money by the New Zealand government, and this is like multiple million dollars, to develop... They've called it the wasp to kill all wasps. And the way they're going to do it is using genetic engineering. And they're genetically engineering male wasps to deliver this, what they call the gene drive, where they alter the DNA of the males so that they produce some sterile, they call sterility, but not to such an extent that the first females that they mate with then just produce a sterile brood. They actually carry that sterility gene on into the next generation. And so actually basically you're generating a population of sterile wasps, which ultimately then die out.
So that sounds like someone watched Jurassic Park.
I know. And I personally am absolutely terrified, because the way that it's so easy for one of these queen to be introduced somewhere with human movement around the world, it's not beyond the realms of possibility that
it could reverse.
That exactly. Then they say they're killing all of our wasps.
Instead it creates a super fertile wasp.
Oh no, that's not what I meant. No.
All right, sorry.
What I meant is that it would create this, that the gene drive wasps might end up coming back to Europe and then wiping out our wasps.
Oh, and then wiping out, of course.
And then the worst case is that I'm out of a job, right?
I mean, that is correct. That is worst case scenario. I wish more scientists would be more honest like that, Sarian. I really wish they would be.
I know, exactly. It's just all about me. No, it's not about me. It's about the ecosystem. And, you know, everyone asks me what would happen if all the wasps died out. Because everybody talks about if all the bees die out, you know, humans will die out within 4 years or whatever. And there's no substance to that. But, you know, life would be tough if the bees die. What about wasps? Would life be tough if wasps died out? And it would be, because wasps regulate all these other insect populations. We would be inundated with, you know, flies and spiders and all sorts of other arthropods. So wasps are doing a really good job in keeping their populations in check, as do many other top predators in the ecosystem. So
absolutely,
they are a really important part of the ecosystem. So yes, it would be very bad if wasps, which are native, are wiped out. But I'm sure that won't happen.
Also, I think it's good to risk assess. It's good to risk assess and highlight these things.
So in order for them to make sure that doesn't happen, they are, of course, going to be doing thorough surveys of the type of genetic diversity that they find in native environments, making sure that the genes that they edit are genes that are not found in those native environments. So it should be fine, but I just, you know, you said Jurassic Park. I'm slightly worried about that.
I mean, I don't think it'll be that level, but, you know, sounds like someone watched it and got an idea. So my last question for you, just to like kind of wrap this up, because on the show so far, we've kind of, you know, we discussed different levels of like whether we should be doing this, although we've made errors and maybe accidentally purposely taken animals somewhere. Should we then control them, or should we let nature take its course, or should we alter it? Should we kill them? Should we, you know, do these biocontrols? For you, what do you think, where do you sit with that when we're looking at wasps? Do you think it is our responsibility to take ownership of this and clear up some mess that we have created, whether accidentally or purposely? Or do you think it's more of a case of we're just going to have to, maybe the safest bet and the most ethical bet is to actually just step back?
So I think I'm going to sit on the fence here, because I can see both sides. I think there's a really interesting case much closer to home, actually, which is with the yellow-legged Asian hornet, which is invading Europe. So it arrived in France in 2004. Again, it was only like a handful of queens. And now it expanded at 100 kilometres a year across France. And now it's spilled over into much of continental Europe. And it does outcompete our native hornet, which is a beautiful insect and very important part of the ecosystem. Yeah. But in a way, it replaces its role in the ecosystem as a top predator. But it's a much more voracious hunter than our native hornet.
Right.
And beekeepers in particular were concerned about it. And I know beekeeping is really important as an industry, but there's also the wild insects, wild bees to worry about.
Yeah, a lot more of them.
And actually, the sort of the the information that is coming out now is that these Asian hornets, these yellow-legged Asian hornets, are potentially more of a threat to other social wasps than they are to honeybees. And so that terrifies me. And then last year in the... Well, we have had a few visitations and records in the UK over the last few years. But last year, we had more records than all of the last 6 years put together. Wow. Until last year, the UK government had a very effective system for when there was a sighting, they would track down that hornet and they would locate the nest and they would remove the nest. And that works when you have just a few invaders. But I'm very, very interested and scared to see what happens this summer, because they're already seeing queens in parts of southern England, which means that actually they must have overwintered, which means there were successful nests that produced sexuals which were clearly not destroyed. So it is only, we've always said it's a matter of time before they're here. And I think they are now here. So what are they going to do in our ecosystem? Well, it's almost impossible to control them. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try to. So I think we should continue the very effective mechanism for removing nests where we can. But there's no way that we will completely... you can see in France how successful these insects have been. But there's some interesting anecdotal ideas, stories about how the impacts of the yellow-legged Asian hornet in France, for example, it's been there for longest, like 20 years now, it has not been quite as extreme as they were expecting. And so it's a possibility that, the ecosystem has kind of put itself in equilibrium and it kind of, things work itself out. And the Asian hornet needs prey, a certain amount of prey, in order to produce colonies successfully. And so if the ecosystem can't support a huge influx of these insects, then ultimately those will also start, their own populations will start to be regulated. So I think we have to be realistic about the fact that, yes, we should try to stop these invasive insects, but ultimately they are a lot cleverer than us. and I think there's a really interesting story about the another kind of invasive insect, which is the Harlequin ladybird. Which has now more or less completely replaced. It's completely here now. And I'm not a ladybird expert, but I've heard the ladybird experts say, well, they are kind of fulfilling the same ecological niche that our native ladybird filled. And so in terms of the ecosystem being stable or evolving, it's kind of, that's what happens in nature. And there's always been dispersal and range expansions and contractions through evolutionary time. So ecosystems are not static. They're constantly changing. And sure, we are accelerating the rate at which these invasive insects spread across the world and get into places where they probably would never have got by their own means. But, nature is clever. Nature is resilient. I'm kind of hopeful that, nature will win in the end and the whole ecosystems will kind of stabilise.
Huge thanks to Serin for coming on the show again. If you haven't listened to her episode about wasps, I think about a year and a half ago, do look back and search for it. It's such a lovely episode. As you can see, she's a beautiful communicator. It's filled with humour, which I love when I'm learning about wildlife and stuff. Really interesting point from Serin there, though, about wasps specifically and some insects, is that, again, it is case by case. There are some insects out there that, like the Harlequin ladybird. Now, we will both admit we're not ladybird experts, so I'll be careful what I say here. But there are many people that believe that the Harlequin ladybird is now delivering what some of our native species would deliver. So from an ecosystem perspective, have we lost there? We might have maybe losing or have lost certain species of ladybird, but we have not lost the job that is being done. Whereas there are other species, such as the Asian hornet, which is currently being reviewed at the moment, they're definitely here. Which Serin said, which is a case that is going to be reviewed ongoingly because there are some concerns, or it might be kind of fine. We're kind of unsure at the moment. So really interesting how it's that kind of case by case again. So thank you, Serin, for coming on the show.
Nice. I really like that. I think that we need to give more grace and celebrate more species that are here. Mm. And when you are feeling a disdain towards them, spend time with that feeling. Why are you feeling that? Because there have been things that we've lost. Take a moment to grieve it. Take a moment to welcome things that are doing and providing a lovely little ecological niche for us as well.
Absolutely.
Okay, so lastly, but not leastly, it's
absolutely
leafy.
Not leastly. we're now going to look at plants.
well, actually, me and Ryan were planning this episode. I was just like, do you know what? There's actually something I talk about in the book that I plugged earlier on, which was this idea of species hierarchy. And so often we do, like me and Ryan, we're guilty of this. We want to talk about the big sexy animals. We want to talk about the things with charisma, the things that we relate to as humans, the things like dormice that we can be like, oh, it's so cute. Plants sustain us. Without plants, we are dead. And plants need the kind of love, care and attention and respect and acknowledgement that all animals do. And there's nobody who loves plants more than Leif Bursweden. This guy is, oh my God. I think he just
annoyingly emotional about them, but yeah. I love it.
Yeah. He just like photosynthesizes every morning and he's just like.
He's very rooted.
He's so rooted. And so actually, rooted. Yeah, so I can imagine we don't think about, when we talk about killing, but you don't think about plants, do you?
Absolutely, but it happens.
Put your, what's it called?
I don't know what you're going to say.
There's like one just that all garden centres say.
Bleach.
Fucking hell. You can tell you're working bomb. Class.
Hot water.
Boiling water. Anyway, put your herbicides down. Once and for all, everybody, let the weeds grow. Let's hear from Leif.
Leif, it is lovely to have you on the show. And I don't mean this in a offensive way, but when we're not just talking about a book, we're actually here to talk about a topic.
So refreshing, isn't it? I do tend to bang on and on. About these things that I've written. So, yes.
It's nice, just to have you on to talk about plants generally.
Yeah, it is. I feel, I don't know, justified in being a botanist rather than just a writer just being here.
Oh, well, I'm glad I've done that for you.
Yeah.
let's jump straight in. You know what the topic is. We're talking about kind of this feeling of killing for conservation. And I feel it's very important that we talk about this across all aspects of life, including flora. So when we're looking at killing for conservation, what methods do we tend to use, Leif, when we're looking at plants that we would like to remove from an area?
So, yeah, obviously with plants, it's slightly different. I think with a lot of animal culling, it requires, you know, some kind of like field craft, basically, you know, because it's humans hunting other animals. So whether that's stalking or trapping or tracking or shooting or whatever it is, it requires that, like, I don't know, a certain level of skill, if you like, that we don't tend to see in a lot of life generally.
Yeah.
Whereas plants, obviously their roots are the spot, they're not going to run away. You don't, as long as you know where they are, then you can kind of get rid of them. So the ways that we do it are basically everything that people tend to do in their gardens. So cutting stuff, felling stuff, just like chopping things, uprooting plants, poisoning plants, you know, in some cases, well, in quite a lot of cases, herbicides and things are used. Generally speaking, anything you can think of that people do to plants in their gardens is done to sort of cull plants in the wild.
And is it easy to target plants in regards, when you're talking about poisons and herbicides, are these like generic ones or can these be targeted per species?
That's a very good question. So generally, well, there are basically different levels. There's like increasingly powerful herbicides. So some plants that maybe, you know, you want to get rid of, just need like a general glyphosate herbicide, which is used incredibly widely. But I do think perhaps with things like, I don't know this for sure, but I think things like rhododendron, I think maybe because they're so hard to get rid of, I think maybe they have a more powerful herbicide. But to be completely honest, I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah. How do you think, like, because one of the topics that we've, or one of the focuses we've had on this kind of conversation, on this episode so far, is our kind of feeling towards removing. But do you think kind of that needs to be consistent across the board? You know, when, how do we feel about removing hedgehogs from an island where they're not meant to be there? But, you know, if we're talking about like Himalaya balsam or something, the feelings aren't going to be the same. But how, I know it sounds weird to say, like, we should we feel more empathy for the hedgehog than we should the Himalaya balsam? But, like, you know, across the board, do you think it should be consistent, or how do you think people feel about that?
I think that, yeah, I agree. There is an inconsistency. I think people are always going to feel more empathetic towards animals just because, you know, they're more relatable.
Mm.
In the vast majority of cases, the animals are talking about, you know, they've got faces, they've got eyes, you know, they move around in the same kind of ways that we do.
Mm.
And so naturally there's that level of empathy, which we wouldn't necessarily get with plants. But we tend to think of plants as being boring.
Mm.
We tend to think of plants as the background and like the scene set for the animals as being the main characters to run around and play around in. We never think of plants as the characters as well. And as you know, I spend a lot of time talking about that kind of thing and how actually it's really important to think of the plants in the same way as we think of the animals. But yeah, it's a weird one. People are a lot less emotive talking about plants than they are talking about shooting deer or culling squirrels or whatever. And I think, again, I think actually that's largely down to the fact that gardening is a thing.
Yeah.
And the way that we take these plants out is using the same methods as we use in gardens, you know, all that sort of chopping and cutting and, you know, uprooting and stuff. That's something we're very used to seeing, whereas we're obviously not used to seeing things being shot as much as stuff being cut back in the garden.
Well, so one of the questions we've asked Hugh Warwick that was on this show, and something he explores in one of his book, is, you know, should we be doing this? So I guess for plants, do you feel we should be removing species that should not be here, species that kind of take over certain areas of plants? Do you think we should be removing that, putting the time, the resources in, or do you think we should just let nature, so to speak, take its course? Or what do you think is the right thing to do when we're looking at plants and the removal of them?
Very good question. Whoa, so many different things.
Yeah, and it could be a case by case, which we have already said.
Yes. I mean, yes, that's the first thing to say, is very much case by case. I would say that, so recently the Botanical Society of Britain and Ireland released this big 20 plus year study that revealed that for the first time ever, more than half of the wild plant species in the UK or Britain and Ireland have been introduced by humans rather than occurring here naturally. Wow. Since the Ice Age or whatever.
More than half.
More than half.
Jeez.
And it's very easy to sort of immediately think that's a really, really bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But actually the vast majority of those plants are not causing any problems. They're not causing any harm or whatever. A small number of them are invasive. You've mentioned Himalayan balsam.
Yeah.
I've talked about rhododendron, those kind of things. And in those cases, yes, I think where you've got plants that have become invasive, these things that are introduced by humans and start disrupting ecosystems and outcompeting our resident flora, it is important to deal with those. And I think in the conservation sector, we hear these words like invasive and non-native and alien, and they, you know, these words are used to describe plants and animals that have evolved in different habitats and different place, and we have then moved them to a new place. And obviously those terms have massive political implications too, because they're very loaded terms, twinned obviously with language that's used to describe immigrants and things. But it's worth remembering, of course, that we're the ones who brought a lot of these things which are causing problems here on the back of us doing some really pretty dodgy exploitative stuff on the other side of the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, Victorian gardeners in the UK, you know, weren't satisfied with the beautiful flora in their back doorstep. So they went around the world grabbing and snatching all these sort of fancy ass plants from other parts of the world to display instead. And plants they're considered, understandably, to be rooted to the spot and that they don't really move. But actually, they have these amazing ways to move around, and they can spread over really, really long distances by themselves.
Yeah.
But naturally, that would happen really, really slowly. And so in each new place that a plant germinates, they've got these sort of natural checks and balances in place that stop them from dominating and sort of spinning out of control. And so obviously when we take them and plonk them down in a new place that's completely different on the other side of the world to where they've evolved and adapted to being part of an ecosystem, then there's nothing there. Those checks and balances aren't there. If there's nothing there that can keep them in touch, if you like, then they are going to just go for it. You know, they're going to be like, woohoo!
Yes.
And, you know, understandably, they're just kind of, you know, grow and do their thing. And then they'll end up dominating and out-competing lots of other species. So a really visual example of this is up on the west coast of Scotland, you've got a lot of these tiny pockets of temperate rainforest, really, really beautiful old ancient woodlands. And they are being basically taken over by rhododendrons that are replacing all these beautiful forests. And so there are various ways of trying to deal with this problem and restore some of these amazing, beautiful, species-rich old habitats that are being lost and sort of swamped out by rhododendron, which is simply just doing its thing. You know, it's an incredible plant, and I have a lot of respect for the way it lives its life, but it's just, there's nothing here that can take it out. Nothing can eat its leaves. Nothing can handle it next to it in the soil, because it makes the soil really acidic. And so it's one of these plants which just kind of spreads and takes over and just gets rid of everything else. And so I think in cases like that, it is really important to remove those plants that we have, you know, brought back and spread around the country effectively.
Have you got an example of one that, like you said, that has kind of maybe got out that is not actually on the level of rhododendron or Himalayan balsam or something like that?
Oh, loads. everything from really recent things like ivy-leaved toad flax, for example. Right. It's a really common urban plant, grows on walls, has tiny little lilac and yellow flowers and ivy-shaped leaves.
Yes, okay.
And grows on walls. It kind of looks like a snapdragon if you're a gardener. And yeah, it just kind of hangs out on walls. And it's just a really cool plant. It's great to show people on urban plant walks and stuff. It's not causing any problems, and it's just kind of doing its thing in urban environments. That was introduced in, I think, the 1700s from the south of Italy. And then you've got really old things like a lot of our arable plants that grow in like crop fields. Well, that haven't been herbicided.
Yeah.
And those, you know, a lot of our things like poppies, for example, they came in with agriculture sort of 6,000 years ago. Basically, their seeds were in the grain that were brought across from Europe. And so these are all like European plants, you know, these things that we, you know, the poppy is obviously such an iconic. One of the plants, I would say one of the plants which most people have probably heard of the word poppy, even if they don't know what it looks like, which obviously is relatively unusual to have a plant that's so well known and kind of worshipped as this symbol of almost like Britishness at times. And it's like, it's not, you know, it's this European plant.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Do you just say that every November?
Yeah.
Where's your poppy? It's not even British, mate. It's not even British. Europe. Actually a German plant.
So we have so many plants that are just kind of fitting into our flora. And, you know, quietly doing their thing, which is brilliant. And obviously that's going to change loads as well with climate change as well. As things get warmer and too hot in Europe, things will start migrating north. And yeah, I'm all for that. But we've just got to make sure that it's generally plants that have come from completely different ecosystems that are completely unlike anything that we have here. So yeah, rhododendron, Himalayan balsam, all their checks and balances aren't here. So we kind of have to keep an eye on that so that we can be the checks and balances effectively. I can't imagine that there would be many more plants that end up as sort of out of control as rhododendron. It has kind of got to the point where it's going to be incredibly difficult, if not impossible, to completely get rid of that plant from all across the country. But yeah, it's a very, very small number of cases for sure.
Huge thanks to Leif again for coming on. I always love it when Leif's on. I always love having a chat with him. It's great. And interestingly, saying very similar things to Serian, but on a plant level, which is, you know, case by case. There are some plants out there that have escaped from gardens.
Imagine him running along.
Escaped, yeah. Just running down your road, knocking bins over. that are not causing too much trouble, but not really taking over or like delivering for some of our maybe insects as well. But there are others out there that are really taking over and that really could be done with, like, you know, winding their necks in a bit, rhododendrons being one of them, and Himalaya balsam being another one, and Japanese knotweed and things like that. So huge thanks to Leif for giving some perspective on plants. And to get, I guess, to wrap this up, to wrap up this kind
wrap
of...
Wrap
it up. This topic of killing for conservation and also just intervening in general as well with different methods that might not be lethal control. We've said it on the show a couple of times. I think for me personally, case by case, and I think I do agree with the point you made, like, you know, it may be the lethal control, we're too quick to get there without kind of asking why we're at that point. So I think maybe looking at this as a longer term thing rather than a quick, we want to do it quickly. I think it's a tricky one because it's so easy to disconnect yourself away from the activity actually happening.
Yeah.
But a lot of us will always spend that time not actually reviewing how we feel about it. And I think the more I slow myself down with this, the more I realize there is a bit of uncomfortable feelings with it. I mean, I am someone that, you know, the only meat I eat is venison. And I am looking to actually go out to do one of the shoots with my friend to see how I feel about it, to actually explore that. So maybe I will review that at a later date and see how I feel. Maybe that'll be an interesting thing to do. But yeah, I think it's one of these things that if someone said to me, what do you think about killing for conservation? I think my reply would always be, I don't know. It depends when and where what you're talking about.
Yeah,
I think I won't
sure.
be able to really say how I feel until I hear about it. I think it's an option that should be on the table. I don't think it's the first option, is my wrap up. What about you?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think we are too trigger happy in the name of conservation.
Mm,
I think when you wear your NGO branded polo shirt, there is a sense of carte blanche to do what you want because you are the good guys. And believe me, I've been there. I've been in that, like, yeah, I'm sorry, we're just going to have to do it so we can repair our ecosystems while still living a life that feeds into the systems that are actually killing it from the top end. I don't think enough energy sometimes is going into stopping damaging practices that have damaged ecosystems as it does in the trying to fix them from the bottom up. And so much of that is about what can we kill, what can we remove, what can we try and restore. And something that we were discussing privately outside of the podcast was, it is the other side of the coin of also reintroducing and releasing species. Yeah, great. It's a really nice thing to do. I think we rush into it for nostalgia and urgency. And right now, nature does not need us to be urgent. I know you think it does. It needs us to stop, slow down, think, feel our feelings, build relationships intimately with the nature around us, and intuit and act accordingly, I believe, to the things that are in our locale.
Absolutely. Nerds, thanks so much for joining us once again on this episode. I hope we've given you lots to think about. All the links that we've recommended in the write-up of this show, including the link to check out Nadia and Right to Roam's new book, Wild Service, and Hugh's book, Cull of the Wild. Don't forget to follow us on social media. You know how to do that by now. And I know these are trying times, as we always say, but if anyone has anything left in their pockets that you think, do you know what, I'd love to chuck that at my favourite nature and conservation podcast, you
do
can
it now.
Do it right now at ko-fi.com/intothewildpod. But until next time, look after yourselves, enjoy spring, and go find those ashy mining bees. Thanks for tuning into the show, nerds. If you don't already, make sure to follow us on social media at Into the Wild Pod on Twitter and at Into the Wild Podcast on Instagram.
And if you're able to and would like to, you can support the show by tipping us at ko-fi.com/intothewildpod. That buys us the equivalent of a coffee, and we use it to fund more podcasts for your ears.
But until next time, keep well and live the good life.